Hi everyone. So I think we're going to go ahead and get started on the last week that we have for this course. So today we're going to be talking about the trouble with HIV testing. And we're really going to focus on index testing here today, but we'll get into that in a sec. I wanted to touch base on a couple of things around the course before we get started. One is we are issuing course certificates but only for those who have done all of the assignments. So you have to have done every assignment. There were 9 over the course of the course. So if you haven't done them all yet, we're giving everybody until next Friday, July 31st, to get all of your assignments in so that we can comment on them, give you feedback, and then send them back the first week of August. So if you do want to get a course certificate, please do get them in by next Friday for any that you haven't done. I will be getting to exercises again this week, right after today, to get feedback to those that have already been submitted that we haven't sent feedback on yet. The other piece is that we are going to be sending around a survey that we're putting together. Jenny, who's on the call, is going to be putting it together. Just trying to solicit input from all of you who have been part of the course about what's worked in the course, what hasn't worked in the course, what you'd like us to focus on more if we were to redo the course. This is, you know, the first real run that we've done of the course, and we want to get a lot of feedback for how we improve the course for the future, different things that we could focus on, different elements that you liked or didn't like. All of those issues. So please, when we send that out, probably next week, let us know and fill it out. And it's really helpful if we get a lot of feedback, because we do want to make this course. We do want to rerun this course for others in the future and build on what we've learned so far. So any questions on that before we get into this week? Hearing none, seeing none in the chat, I'm going to move on then. So as I said, this week is on looking at the HIV testing program. And I want to really get into this, mostly focusing on index testing. The online module goes into a lot of information about, you know, the different modalities for HIV testing that are part of the PEPFAR program, you know, whether that's facility-based, whether that's antenatal clinics, whether that's VMMC clinics, all of those sorts of things, and the ways that you can access and look at those data. There's a lot of information about recency testing in the online module as well. And there's also some basics about how we can think about costing assessments for different ways of how the PEPFAR program works for the HIV testing program, about how you could run some of those basic costing assessments. Today, however, we just want to focus on how we can tell the story of index testing, because I think there's a really powerful way that the index testing program in particular can be talked about in terms of data. And I think it brings together a lot of the things that we've been talking about throughout this entire course. First, in terms of, you know, what the data are currently telling us about the status of index testing and the rollout of index testing. Also, second, in terms of, you know, what we saw and how the rollout of the index testing program developed in COP guidance over the years, you know, what the guidance meant for the metrics that were established around index testing, what those metrics meant for the implementing partners in terms of how they had to create programs, and ultimately, you know, how those data are useful in understanding the incentives and ways that we could change the way that data are collected that changes the incentive structures for the monitoring of the program. So we're going to focus on that today. When we get to questions at the end, happy to discuss any of the other recency or modalities information as well. So just first on index testing, I know everybody on here already knows, but can somebody just give me a quick overview of what index testing is? You all know what index testing is. Don't be quiet.
Hello, Brian.
Go ahead, Eric.
Wow, you see, it's very interesting because, you know, it's only up until you have this course that when you pose a question, then you begin to crack your head to say, yes, I've used that term in my writings, but what does it mean? Anyway, may I give it a try? Index testing. So, of course, it's a term that we use heavy space, and I know lately it's also being used even in COVID-19, where you have an index test. So it's a I should say that with respect to HIV, we would say it refers to a person that has first been identified or has tested positive. In this case, it could refer also to that person is coming from a household. So in that household, you may have a person that has tested positive. Let me stop.
Okay, so it starts, that's right, Eric. It starts with somebody who's tested positive. And then their household. Anybody else want to add in on that?
Yeah, just to add on what has been said, it's whereby somebody tests positive. It might be in the family, at family level, maybe children or sexual partners.
Right. So what we do in index testing, right, is we identify somebody who's recently tested positive, or that has had a, you know, part of PEPFAR's program is that it also expands to people who have recently had a unsuppressed viral load. So they got a viral load test back, and treatment wasn't working, or they had been off treatment for some period of time and their viral load was detectable. Right, so there's sort of two different people who are eligible to become index clients. And then we ask those people to share who their sexual and needle sharing adult contacts have been, as well as any biological children that they have that are below the age of 15. And the purpose of that is then we can go out and we suggest that those people, the contacts of the person, the index client, the person who tested positive or had a high viral load, come in for testing, so that we can get them tested. If they're not already diagnosed, we can check their viral loads. If they have already been diagnosed, we can link them to prevention. If they're negative, access to PrEP, access to condoms, whatever prevention services are necessary, or we could link them to treatment if they test positive, right? And the point of this is to interrupt ongoing transmission and get more people who have not been previously diagnosed to have access to traditional testing services to get them access to HIV testing, right? In a more proactive way than just waiting for people to test themselves or waiting for people to get sick and then end up getting tested when they come into a clinic because they're sick. And I just want to go into this other piece of this. So that's index testing generally, right? And we're seeing this now, as Eric mentioned, in the context of COVID. It's a very similar thing that's been done called contact tracing, where we're trying to find all of the people who have been potentially exposed to an infectious disease, whether that's HIV, whether that's COVID, whether that would be Ebola, whether it would be any TB, and we want to stop the onward movement of the disease, and be able to intervene. The question that I have for all of you is, what's different about this from a healthcare provider patient relationship? What makes this different than other medical services that are provided?
Hello.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, maybe the difference might be from we can start from the screening tools.
What do you mean in terms of the screening tools?
Yeah, when you screen the client, there should be a very the tool, or most of the tools, they should be very technical, and the technique where you are using in the tools, so somebody may reveal their sexual partners or other people who were involved in that chain of the an issue. It's okay. Different from maybe malaria, because malaria, you can get malaria anywhere. So in terms of HIV, sometimes you know who you had sex with, and if it's a sex workers always doesn't know who is who. It's very rare to know their clients, but from other, I can speak on that ground.
Right. I think you're hitting on the point, right? The point is about, we're asking about things that aren't about individuals that aren't part of the individual patient's care, right? So the person who's serving as the index client is not the service is intended not to benefit necessarily that client, although we can talk about that. The purpose of this healthcare service is to help a third party, you know, the context of the index client in the context of sex workers, that would be their clients, in the context of non-sex workers or others, their needle sharing partners, other adult sexual contacts that they have, their children. The intended beneficiary of index testing is not the client in front of you. And that changes the ethics about how we have to think about index testing. In normal provider-patient relationships, right? The person in front of you, the person talking to the nurse is only offering a service to that individual. Here, they're trying to use the person in front of them, the index client, to access other people. And while there's some, you know, when we think about, you know, what's the rationale for this service, I do want to point out that, you know, index testing or partner notification services started out as a service that was being offered to clients because of difficulties that people had in disclosing their status to their partners, right? And that's a really good service to offer. That's a service that many clients really do want because they struggle to disclose their status to their partners or to their spouses once they've been diagnosed. And having a healthcare provider be part of that process can be a really beneficial service to offer. However, in the way that we think about index testing and the way that I think we've seen a lot of the program roll out, the purpose of the program is really not about the individual client. It's really about how we get access to those other people. And that's just a difference in how we think about how we have to think about index testing as part of this. So I'm just going to turn now to a little bit about, you know, what the data show us about index testing and where we are with the rollout of index testing. And it's important because, you know, PEPFAR has put a lot of pressure on index testing to become a major priority. Much of that because the cost of testing has become very expensive. PEPFAR was doing in 1 year alone over 90 million HIV tests or supporting over 90 million HIV tests, very few of which were coming back positive, right? So we were testing a lot of people who were negative and probably were not at very high risk for being HIV positive in the first place. And they wanted to cut back on that. And they wanted to move to different modalities that improve the testing yield, meaning the number of people who are being diagnosed positive per person who's tested. And they wanted to figure out a way to access people who haven't been accessing traditional HIV testing services, who aren't going into standard BCT clinics, who aren't themselves going forward to clinics to present themselves for HIV testing. Oftentimes young people, oftentimes key populations, you know, that those services have not been either accessible or desirable for people who are still undiagnosed. So here we're looking at the different modalities within PEPFAR's HIV testing program. So in light blue, you've got testing. This is the proportion of HIV positive results that we get out of the HTS TST pause. And so the light blue is how many people are testing or what proportion of people who are testing positive are being tested positive in general facility testing. The dark blue is VCT, so voluntary counseling and testing programs. The pink is antenatal clinics, so women going into antenatal clinics. And then the red is index testing. Orange is mobile testing, and then there's a few others there as well that are relatively small. And what you see is, starting back in 2017, when index testing was really introduced, it was making up a small proportion of the positives that were being identified. And then over the years, as the program has intensified, we see this sort of relatively small incremental growth of the program until, you know, 2019. And this is all PEPFAR countries. So this is the data across all of the PEPFAR countries. You start to see this much bigger growth in what proportion of index testing or what proportion of positives are coming from index testing here in the red. And it's 23 in this last chart, last bar here. It's about 23% of all positives are being identified through index testing in PEPFAR generally. For Malawi, we see, you know, a similar sort of pattern. The program has remained relatively small. It's begun to increase in the last couple of quarters in ways that I think are something that we should be concerned about. But it's still only reached about 18.5% here as of 2020 quarter two. It's only about 18.5% of positives are coming through index testing. In Zimbabwe, sort of similar story, only you do start to really see a much larger proportion of positives coming from index testing. you also see here this really large drop in voluntary counseling and testing, where it appears PEPFAR has just dropped out of a lot of funding of voluntary counseling and testing programs, because very few positives are now coming through that modality. But even here, we've seen, as we would sort of expect, the expansion of index testing from 2019. And then in the last couple of quarters, it started to go down, I think partially because of those communications that were made as part of COP20, where the human rights implications of index testing were raised with the PEPFAR team, and new guidance was issued to reduce the amount of pressure that was being put on clients to consent to index testing. And then we have Tanzania. And Tanzania is a very different story from Malawi and from Zimbabwe and from what we see globally. This is a similar sort of story that we see in Kenya as well, pretty similar in Uganda as well, where instead of just a relatively small growth in index testing, we really see this explosion of reliance on index testing in the last couple of years from the beginning of 2019. And now index testing is, in this most recent quarter, almost 60% of all the positives that they're identifying. And we've identified this, you know, we'll talk about the data that we've collected later, that, you know, people on the ground have collected later, to think about, well, what does this mean in terms of the human rights of people, about access to services, about consent, and the way that this plays out. What's not available, and this is an interesting point, is that the previous data are just the data that PEPFAR is making available through the HTS-TST indicator. These are all the MER indicators, right, from PEPFAR. The HTS-TST, the HTS-TST pause, the number of positives identified. And then by extension, we could also look at the yield for each different modality. So we can look at all of those. But PEPFAR actually has a much more meaningful indicator on index testing called HTS index. And you're seeing it here from the MER manual on the right side of the screen. But they have continually refused to make and release data on from the HTS index indicator, which provides a much more thorough accounting of the cascade of index testing, right? So what HTS index does is it collects data about how many individuals were offered index testing, how many of those individuals accepted index testing, how many adult and child contacts did the person provide, or at a facility level, how many adult contacts did index clients overall provide? And then how many of those contacts were actually followed up and tested for HIV? And how many of those people received the results, right? And so we can track that whole cascade, offer, accept, number of contacts, and then how many of those were tested, right? Now, just because PEPFAR hasn't made these data available doesn't mean we can't demand access to them. And that is something we should keep doing through the port reviews. You know, everybody here, I think, is aware of the port reviews. And we have seen these data out of Uganda. We'll talk about this in a little bit. What I want to say about that is we almost never see these data, but their absence tells us a lot about what PEPFAR is measuring and what PEPFAR cares about when they're measuring what's going on with the index testing program. That they're gathering these data, but then never actually analyzing them. That they don't include analysis of these data in the port reviews, in what they're communicating out around the program, suggests that they don't actually pay attention to this indicator very much, right? And that's concerning because this is where we could see much more of the information about how well human rights are being respected within the program. That consent is being fully verified, all of those sorts of issues. So that's where we are with sort of the status of the index testing program. Before I really move on, I'm going to move on. So what I want to look at now, and these next slides are going to be very wordy, I apologize, but I want to look at how we got here with index testing. How did PEPFAR move the program, as you saw here, from a program in Tanzania that was only having a relatively small number of people identified through the index testing modality, to now it being almost 60%. What was the process that PEPFAR used to get there from a headquarters level? Because it's important in terms of how we think about the program. So here, we're just gonna go through what was said in COP guidance from COP 17 through COP 20. And then we're gonna come back and think about what this means in terms of how PEPFAR used data and used metrics to create pressure, right? So this is where we started in COP 17 guidance, where what they basically said is we have to think about strategic testing, including partner notification and index-based testing as opportunities for clients, but there was no requirement that index testing be considered for rollout, but there was no requirement that it actually be implemented. There were no targets for implementation that were put in place. There was some communication of case studies and different implementing partner examples of how index testing could work. And they highlighted the importance of index testing in terms of improving yields so that you could do less testing and identify more people, right? Or identify the same number of people. So very low risk, very, very little pressure, just saying every country team needs to consider this as an option. Then in COP 18, we move on and we see, you know, there's some additional information that, you know, partner notification should be client-centered and focused on the needs and safety of index clients and his or her partners and children. That the client gets to choose the best option for his or her circumstances, and that services are being delivered in a non-judgmental manner. There's a lot of discussion about consent, that there's this desire, as we see in the top right, to reach epidemic control, partner notification should be done for all current and new patients with documentation, right? So we really want to move towards index testing by really putting forward a lot of language and a lot of incentive and a lot of clear communication about consent and, you know, safety of clients as the most important thing. It was required that index testing become a service that is offered at high volume sites, but that was it. Just, you have to offer this as a service at high volume sites. There were no targets for implementation. They didn't say how many people had to be identified through index testing versus other forms of testing. And then again, there was this clear presentation of rights of individuals. Then we get into COP 19 guidance. And this is where we really saw things change. Because we saw the creation and the start of metrics around this issue. So one, in the COP guidance, they said, first of all, you have to start implementing this now as part of COP 18 implementation, not wait until October to start implementing what we're going to talk about in the COP guidance here. And the first thing that they did was then set proportionate targets that said that 30 to 50% of all new positives identified had to come from index testing. So now they've set that target. They also set a minimum programmatic acceptance rate that said that at least 80% of clients who are offered index testing must consent to serve as an index client, or the program is considered failing and needs to be reviewed. They also said that there was a minimum programmatic requirement that index clients had to provide at least on average 1.5 adult contacts per client. And they say this in the words of that traditional HIV testing or traditional partner notification services were always good at finding the primary spouse, but they were never good at moving beyond that. So we're now going to require everybody to get at least 1.5 contacts on average per index client. They also set minimum yield expectations so that they had to achieve at least yields, meaning 20 to 40% of the contacts that were tested had to test positive or the program was considered failing. And then there was some mild language about that the team should engage with civil society in order to make sure that these programs are being done in a safe and human rights focused manner. But that was really it. That operating units need to note any questions and concerns raised by civil society and identify measures to address those. But they didn't change any of the metrics. The metrics were there, right? So then we get into COP20, and this is where we, you know, had raised a lot of concerns, and we saw in January when the COP guidance was issued that there was an immediate suspension of the program, at least temporarily, because of concerns raised by civil society about the index testing program, that it was leading to rights violations, that people were, that their consent was not being respected, that there were many reports of abuse, that there were many reports that services were being conditioned, meaning other health services like treatment were being withheld from patients unless they consented to index testing. However, despite that change in the guidance up front saying we're putting a halt in place, particularly around key populations, and the safety of these programs need to be reviewed, they maintained all of those same metrics, right? Minimum programmatic acceptance rates were still set at 80% of clients had to consent to serve as an index client, or the facility, as it says in sort of that middle orange line, that failure to reach high rates above 80% should warrant programmatic review to ensure index testing is implemented with the appropriate fidelity, scale, and quality. So what they're saying, you can see what they're saying there. They still had the minimum programmatic requirement for adult contacts per client, though it went down a little bit. They went down to, you had to be at least above one on average. You had to be at least above one instead of 1.5. The other thing that they changed is there's different ways that index testing can be done. There's patient referrals where individual patients say, I'm going to refer my contacts to the clinic. I will notify them and tell them. And then there's provider assisted referral, in which the providers are the ones who take control and decide that they're the ones who are going to contact the clients, right? And it leaves the provider in much more control of how index testing goes forward. And what PEPFAR said is that now we're moving to say provider-assisted referral, where the healthcare provider is in charge of which contacts get actually notified, is the most preferred and recommended approach. And they did that because they saw, or they think they saw, that the success rate is much higher if the provider is in control of the situation, because the patients themselves were choosing not to refer their contacts for testing. So they put that pressure on. They said that programs should focus on provider-assisted referral. And then they said there was a promise that minimum standards and guidance on monitoring mechanisms would be issued. We are still waiting to hear what those are going to be. We have received some materials over the last 6 months. Those materials continue to fail to meet those expectations, or the expectations around what genuine guidance and expectations are. So that's sort of how we got here, right? How it moved the program from being this program focused on right, to and where index testing made up a relatively small portion of it, of all the positives, to one where it's over 60%. And I just want to, you know, bring this back now to ask, you know, thinking about how PEPFAR did this, because I think it's important from a data perspective to think through. So from a data perspective, how did PEPFAR do this? What are the metrics that they established that we just talked through? And what metrics didn't they establish? So let's just start with what metrics did they establish, right? I think we went through them. Who's got a metric that they established? It's last week, people. Okay, nobody's going to volunteer. So let's think about the metrics that we talked through, right? What they put in place for the programs. They said, there's gotta be a minimum percentage of positives that are going to come from index testing, right? 30 to 50% in COP20, as you're seeing on the screen here, for some countries, they raised that to at least 75% of positives have to come from index testing, right? So that's one metric. They set a metric around minimum client acceptance rates, saying that at least 80% of clients should be consenting to be in, to serve as index clients. They set a metric around the minimum number of contacts per index client on average. They did set, we didn't talk about it, but a minimum HIV test acceptance rates of those, of the contacts who were contacted. So they said at least 80% of the contacts who we end up communicating with have to consent to HIV testing or you're missing the mark. And then they set a metric around the minimum yield for index clients, right? So all of those are different metrics that PEPFAR chose to measure as part of its program. Minimum percentage of positives coming from index testing, minimum acceptance rates, minimum number of contacts per client, minimum acceptance rate for HIV testing, and then minimum yields. What didn't they establish in terms of metrics? Well, they didn't establish a maximum acceptance rate, right? To flag when facilities are overriding consent. They didn't set any metrics really to monitor that consent process. While they talked about intimate partner violence and gender-based violence as important parts of the program, they chose not to implement any metrics to monitor whether screening for intimate partner violence or whether there was any was actually in place. And they chose not to implement any metrics to follow up with clients to ensure that any adverse events, whether individuals faced negative ramifications of having participated in index testing, they chose not to gather any data on those, right? And have those data reported back. And why is that important? It's important because the ways that we create metrics, the ways that PEPFAR establishes metrics, creates pressure for the implementing partners in terms of how their programs are going to be evaluated and the pressures that they're going to be under in order to implement those programs. So if we think about this, you know, they put a lot of pressure on partners saying you have to get at least 30 to 50% of your positives through index testing or you're failing and we may remove your funding. And they said at least 80% of your clients must consent to index testing or you're failing and we might take your money away. But they didn't put in anything to counter pressure those targets to make sure that all of the human rights protections that are necessary for index testing were put in place. Right? And that's, you know, I think one of the things that we've tried to communicate throughout this course is what you measure is what gets programmed for. Right? So the fact that they chose what to measure and all of those measurements were on the side of do more index testing, get more acceptance of index testing, and get more clients per context of index testing. And then they chose not to measure any potential downsides of index testing, tells you what the programs have to focus on. So if you're an implementing partner and you know nobody is coming to the facility to assess whether the human rights are being protected, but if I don't meet these targets, my money might be taken away, right? And my program is going to be flagged as underperforming. That's the way that we create pressure. That's the way that they create pressure and inappropriate pressure in this case on how programs are going to be delivered. Right? Does that make sense? So now I want to talk about the other piece of the story, about how we responded with data, about how we can respond with data and thinking about the different ways that you know, people on this call, people on this responded to the index testing program with data, right? And I think there's a few different ones. There's the community-led monitoring efforts, there's modeled data that we did a little bit of work with, and then there's looking at the programmatic data where it is available to identify how these issues really play out, right? Community-led monitoring, many of the people on here have been part of, were part of. I'm just going to highlight a few of those that came out of the People's COPs and out of the NACOFA report. So here's from the People's COP in South Africa, where community-led monitoring efforts identified that 70% of facility managers said that they, only 70% of facility managers said that they screen for intimate partner violence. So 30% of facilities aren't even bothering to screen for intimate partner violence before they contact the contacts of index clients. And the majority of facility managers, 53%, who do screen for intimate partner violence said that they contact the partners anyways, regardless of whether the client reported violence from that contact. Only 14% of the facility managers interviewed said that they don't trace or contact clients who reported violence, right? And that's disturbing and that's an inappropriate use of the program. In Malawi, this is not directly related to index testing, where I think there have been fewer concerns around index testing in Malawi that have come up. Maureen maybe wants to say a couple of things or others. But that one thing that did come out of Compass work was this report that in some of the CHAM facilities, there are fees that are assessed for women who don't bring their partners in for antenatal services or for HIV testing when they attend antenatal services. And that's a discriminatory practice and really, really dangerous. And we can think about it as really dangerous in the context of index testing as well. In Kenya, where again, we've seen a lot of problems around the index testing program and that scale up was similar to what we saw in Tanzania. one of the things that was reported is that, you know, the reports of violence, again, on intimate partner screening, the reports of violence were often ignored in favor of targets, right? That the implementing partners were moving forward with contacting the clients of sex workers or the contacts of index clients because they had to meet targets. And that was the point. Instead of this being run as a consent-based program. In Tanzania, there was the Nakofa report that was, I think everybody who has seen it and read it, highly disturbing in terms of what it identified. One of the things that it did identify was this, which was that only 31% of individuals that were interviewed as part of the community-led monitoring effort said that their consent to participate in that index testing was being respected. And that Nakofa report was hugely influential. So those are some of the community-led monitoring efforts that were done. There's also some modeled data that we have worked with. This is showing an example from Tanzania, where we wanted to look at how, you know, when PEPFAR sets these targets around what proportion of index testing or what proportion of positives have to come from index testing. What was said at the time and what was said early on was, are those reasonable? Is it possible to actually achieve those targets given what we know about the program? And so this is all discussed much more thoroughly in the online module, and there's a piece of this that's available as well. Hilda, did you have a question? Sorry, I see you unmuted. So what we're doing here, and this is just an example of how we can think about the use of data to respond to the targets that PEPFAR sets, is we create a model or a calculator or do some calculations with data where we say, here, as we're showing here, these were the targets that PEPFAR was setting, where their positives to identify was 231,202. They wanted to get 60% of their positives through index testing. What that would mean is they would need to get 138,000 people from index testing, and 92,000 would come through other modalities, traditional testing modalities, non-index modalities, right? And then we can start running numbers. We can say, okay, well, if we have a pool of 92,481 people that are possible to serve as index clients, and we assume that a certain percentage of those are going to accept index testing, and then we're gonna get a certain number of contacts per client, we're gonna successfully track a certain number of people, we're gonna get certain yields out of those people that we successfully track. We can actually then calculate how many people do we actually expect to get out of this program, right? And what we find when we run this sort of analysis country by country, but here in Tanzania, is that their target of 138,721, when we run the assessment, utilizing all of the assumptions that they say we should use, we only expect to find 66,000, right? So they're setting targets that are unachievable. And again, as we talked about, that creates pressure on the program to overemphasize and get much higher acceptance rates than are actually possible with genuine consent processes. The other thing that we have, and Ken can speak to this as well, because Ken's the one who's been getting access to the data in Uganda, where this is the only place where we have been getting the HTS index cascade of data. And what we've seen when we've looked at those data is that from that first point to that second point, right, we talked about the cascade as being number of clients offered index testing, and then number of people who accept index testing as a service, and then number of people who, or number of contacts solicited from those people who accept, et cetera. When we looked at the facility level data in Uganda, again, the only place that it's been made available to us is in Uganda. What we see is there's 769 facilities total in Uganda that are doing index testing. 494 of those, that's this first bar here, have 100% acceptance rates, meaning every single person who was offered index testing supposedly consented to index testing. Almost about 75%, a little bit over 75%, have above 90% acceptance rates. That's the percentage of facilities. And the reason we look at it this way is because it shows that consent isn't really part of this process for index testing, right? We can look at these numbers and we can say, nobody consents 100% of the time. There's no place where you should get consent 100% of the time. And when we look at the literature on consent for index testing, where programs that were pilot programs and published data on research, what we find is actually only about 60% of people ever really consent to participate in index testing. In many of them, it's actually below 40% of people will actually accept index testing services. And even in those situations, it's usually more about contacting their primary sexual partner as opposed to all partners. These studies haven't really been done amongst key populations. So the fact that we're getting in Uganda that they are documenting through their programmatic data that most of their facilities, 65%, 64%, have 100% acceptance rates means that these pressures that PEPFAR has put on has caused the implementing partners to implement and the healthcare providers to be quite clearly or raise concerns that the healthcare providers are putting undue pressure on the clients to accept index testing and participate in index testing. So that's this array of different ways that we've, that civil society has brought data into this process of reviewing the index testing program. So we had that, then there's this piece of how do we convert that into advocacy, right? And in Kenya, I think this is a good example of what was done in Kenya. So we have, we brought in the data from the community-led monitoring efforts. We brought in data from the modeled data. We brought in data that we just talked through about the programmatic data on acceptance rates and realized that they're not really realistic. Converting that into advocacy then was about how do we get PEPFAR to think about index testing and think about different ways to monitor the index testing program. And a lot of this was discussed in Johannesburg in February. Those of you who are there will remember. But I think one of the points that Matt Kavanaugh likes to make, and I think is a really good point, is if the US government wants to do something or is going to care about something, they have to measure it and they have to set a target around it, right? And so in Kenya, what we worked on and what we did was put a lot of pressure on the country team to start sharing data. And we put it into the SDS and we made it a requirement in the SDS that on a monthly basis, PEPFAR Kenya would report all of these indicators that you see on the right. They would report every month how many facilities were offering index testing, how many clients were offered, how many accepted, how many contacts per client were in each of those facilities, so that we can start reviewing those data and identifying facilities that have inappropriately high rates of acceptance. And we got them to agree that any facility that had over 75% acceptance of index testing would be flagged for review by the PEPFAR team themselves, so that they would have to go and investigate and make sure that the consent procedures are actually in place. And this is just to say, these are the types of things that we should be demanding generally, because it's a way that we can think about the utilization of data and of metrics to force the advocacy, not just from ourselves, but also into the internal processes that PEPFAR works by, right? By putting pressure on the team to create metrics, it puts them in a position where they have to analyze the data in the way that we want them to analyze the data, so that they have to follow up and they become accountable to the system and to making sure that human rights are in place. Now, I will say in Kenya, unfortunately, with COVID, these data haven't been being delivered on the basis that, on the regularity that they're supposed to be being made available, but we have been following up on that. And we're hoping all of this is going to get remedied very soon. So that's really today. And I wanted to do this as this sort of story about the way that index testing rolled out from a data perspective, so that we can think about, you know, these different ways that we've talked about over the course of this course, the programmatic data, the financing data, the sort of modeling and academic literature data and community-led monitoring efforts, and how those all really come together in the context of index testing to monitor that program and how it really played out in data. So I think with that, I'm just gonna open it up to questions, and we can have questions about index testing. We can have questions about, you know, as we had in the online module, the different modalities for testing, or the recency testing, if anybody wants to ask about recency testing. And I know we're at time, so, but.
Maybe I'll start just by saying one thing. I think one of the things that's been really valuable and is valuable about thinking about index testing is the ways in which we're understanding the direction of PEPFAR's decision making and sort of trying to unravel that a little bit and explain the implications of the decisions that they've made back to them, right? So like they'll say, they've made this decision, as Eric pointed out, this is like an efficiency argument, right? We need to get this many positives and we only have this much amount of money to spend on tests because treatment costs a lot of money. And that means we need to do things like have a lot of index testing. And what we've been able to do through the data that communities have gathered, through the modeling that we're doing, is explain back to them, in order for that to happen, you need to be doing like 90% acceptance rate of a service that we know is not acceptable to 90% of people. So if that's what you're seeing human rights violations, right? And so being able to like, they're doing this very, what sounds like a simple thing, they're setting a target for this, and just unraveling that story back to them through the data has proved to be a really powerful advocacy tool.
Quiet group. Okay, well, if nobody has any additional questions or thoughts at the moment, I think the point Austin just made is really good, which is, you know, sometimes the power that we have as civil society, there's data that we collect and put forward. And those data can sometimes be challenged by PEPFAR. I think one of the beautiful things that we have here is by utilizing not just the data that we're collecting as part of community-led monitoring efforts or as, you know, community data systems, but utilizing PEPFAR's own data to create this challenge for them in terms of the advocacy, where they have, where they're forced into either accepting their own data or refuting their own data. And we have this different array of pieces of the data that are all pointing in the same direction, right? The community-led monitoring efforts are saying, we're identifying rights violations that are happening. We're identifying that the facilities that are implementing index testing aren't doing it according to the guidance that you put out, that it's supposed to be in accordance with the WHO's 5 C's, that it's supposed to be consent-based. We have the modeled data saying that it's impractical to achieve these sorts of levels. And we have the programmatic data all saying, all pointing in the direction that these sorts of high levels of achievement on index testing have been, are inappropriate and a signal that things are actually going wrong in the program. So I think just think about that in terms of moving forward, how we think about not just one data point or thinking about one piece of data and one solution to the problem, but having all of these different pieces available and these different ways to look at the program in data creates the an argument that's much stronger.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. Maybe to add my voice to that, I think the Uganda case is a classical example of how the different pieces of data, Brian and Austin are talking about, that's been very, very successful. From their program data, we're able to tell this abnormality in acceptance rates, and it correlated very, very well with the what we are finding through like People's Corp, the high rates of violence, the personal testimonies that colleagues were sharing of the poor implementation of index testing. And that forced our government to change. Before, our government actually had said that they would go ahead despite PEPFAR's decision to halt index testing. And but now they've revisited that. Actually, it's government now taking lead. They halted it. They're doing an assessment. They've involved us from right from start up today to guide them. Actually, they keep coming back to us for guidance on how to conduct this assessment. They are now going to accredit all their government facilities based on the minimum standards that are provided by OGAC and also input from civil society. So it's one classic example of how the different pieces of data can be powerful in influencing policy. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah, I think the Uganda example is really good. And it's good to hear government is now stepping in because to make sure that process is done correctly. And those government facilities, I mean, we've seen this also in Kenya and elsewhere. A lot of the problems have come up in government facilities where, and in South Africa, frankly, where PEPFAR may or may not actually have a lot of authority over the individual healthcare workers. So they have authority over the pressures that are created, but they have a harder time correcting the process after they've implemented poor quality programming. PEPFAR acting alone does. So I know we're over on time, so I'm just gonna thank everybody. Again, just going back, we are going to be issuing course certificates. Again, you need to do all 9 assignments in order to qualify for a certificate. Assignments have to be in by next Friday, so July 31st. And then we'll be sending a survey next week because we really do, again, want to learn a lot more about how we can improve the course when we offer it again. So thanks everyone for being part of this. It's been a really fun thing to do for the last, 3 months or however long it's been, 9 weeks, 10 weeks, that we've been going on with the course. And thanks everybody who's been, really participatory in the process as well.
Thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Oh, thank
you.
Thanks, Brian and Austin. It's amazing how time flies so fast, but it's been an amazing experience. The distance. We'll be invited to shadow some of the next course of fellows. Because it's been really, really exciting. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.